Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Merle Exit. Well, it's still hot here in New York City. It's noon time. I understand. Well, I haven't been out. I understand the humidity is down. But listen, I'm in my house doing the show, and that's what counts, and there's some air conditioning. So, and we have a really good show. We have interesting guests today. One of them is Patricia Glunt, and she is the artistic director and founder of Jackson Heights Orchestra. It's located in Jackson Heights in Queens, New York. Listen, there aren't very many women that get to conduct an orchestra. So we're going to talk about this. And then after that, Dan Guarino is a writer, photographer, and entertainer, lives in a town in Queens called Broad Channel. It's basically a long strip of land in a water-abound community, meaning that, yes, it got hit with Sandy. Well, Dan recently authored a photographic and captioned book about the history of the area, and we'll talk with him. So right now we're going to I'll do a commercial afterwards, and we'll talk now to Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hey, Merle. How are you?
Okay. So,
thank you for inviting me on the show today.
Well, anytime. So tell me, how did this all come about that you got to, conduct an orchestra?
Well, I figured it's something that I've always wanted to do, and I have a couple of extra free moments in my life and decided to start a community orchestra in Jackson Heights, and I became its fearless leader. So I went to the beautification group, the Jackson Heights Beautification Group, and they were kind enough to say, let's do it, and they helped me out with it, and the rest is history, I guess.
So when you say the beautification group, so this is this is not anything like BID, right? This is just a group.
No, it's the Jackson Heights Beautification Group started, I think, 28 years ago, with basically the idea was to remove graffiti in the area and just make Jackson Heights more beautiful, plant trees and flowers and do the weeding and cleaning up. And it, over the years, it has helped sponsor many, many startup groups in the area, like our dog run and the orchestra. And they did a chamber music series for a while. And, many people who have come to them with an idea that would help Jackson Heights, they said, sure, let's help you make this happen. That's what I did. I went to Ed Wesley, the former president of the organization, and he said, sounds like a great idea, and let's make it happen. So they helped with it, and they've been very supportive ever since.
So, and how did you get the people? Are they professionals?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Some plays are semi-professional. Some are amateurs. Some played in high school and some in college. And it's a real mixed bag. It's it is It's an adult community orchestra. So I held auditions and nobody came. No, a few people came and
yeah.
We started the group with about 9 members in September or October of 2012. And the first concert was scheduled in December. So I scrambled to get a few more members. I borrowed and stole from other community groups and say, I need a couple more string players. I need a couple of wind players. And we gave our first concert in December of 2012 with 18 people. And it since has grown to about, we have about 30 members in the orchestra now. And we've been around, we're starting our 5th year this year.
Well, that's fabulous. And so in other words, in your thing was really like, I really would like to conduct an orchestra.
Yeah, basically. And nobody was asking me. So now, you know, this is something that's been on the back of my mind for a very long time. When I moved to New York in the early 80s, I moved to Astoria and I had made plans. You know, I had diagrams and writings of how to start a community orchestra, and I figured that in Western Queens there was nothing that filled that void. And of course then I started working and then I worked more and I worked harder and then one day I retired. You know, so I looked back and said, well, this is what I really wanted to do. In the meanwhile, the Astoria Symphony had already started. So I knew that Astoria was really not the place for me. And that group did start out as a community orchestra and is now a semi-professional group. But there was still a need for the amateur musician in Western Queens to have a venue to meet with like-minded people and rehearse and come together and play. And so that's sort of, Jackson Heights has been my home for a long time. And it just seemed like the most logical place to start this. And I had really no idea it was going to take off like it did. But it's just been, I sometimes say the stars were aligned when we started the group. And, you know, we haven't looked back. So it's just been a great, great journey for myself and for the community.
So, in other words, it's like a comparable sort of like community theater, except it's you're playing instruments instead of putting on a show.
Yes. We've done, so far, that's right. It's like community theater. And by the way,
when is the next show? When is the next performance?
The next concert is December 14th.
We
start at 7:30. It's at the St. Mark's Episcopal Church on 82nd Street and 34th Avenue.
And how often, do you guys practice?
Well, we practice once a week, and I like to do, 2 months' worth of rehearsals. So we're going to start rehearsing for this concert October 11th, the day after Columbus Day.
Oh, cool.
So if any of your listeners play an instrument and they're free on Tuesday night and they want to have a good time, they should reach out to me and see if we have a need for what they have to offer.
Do you, find that you have, there are certain, instruments more common. Do you have everything filled?
Well, this year I'm going to focus on building up the strings, and filling in some of the lesser popular instruments like bassoon, trombone, and French horn. So in the woodwinds and brass, we usually have two on each for each instrument, so they run in pairs, and the strings, usually we do many strings, and so I want to build up the string section.
Do you have how about the oboe? You have to have an oboe, of course, right?
Yes, we have an oboe, and we might be having two oboes this year, regulars. Sometimes I have friends come in at the last minute and fill in spots where we're lacking, so that those parts are covered.
Yeah, for years I thought that the concertmaster was the one that tuned up to start until I read something about, oh, it's the oboe that has to blow out the note, the first note.
Right. Well, the oboe traditionally, because of the double reed, the bamboo, and it's traditionally a little more temperamental as far as staying in tune. It's very sensitive to the weather. So what happens is the concertmaster will stand up and give the signal to the oboist. And then the oboist will give the A for everyone to tune to. So you're partially right on that. It's a team effort. The oboe doesn't start until they get the cue from the concertmaster.
What happens if you don't have an oboe player, by the way?
What's that?
I mean, what happens if there is no oboe? I'm just curious. Is there another instrument that could be tuned to?
Well, you can, you know, the oboe it could be doubled on a flute, or it could be rewritten for a clarinet part. I mean, you're just not getting the timbre of the quality of the sound of the oboe. You could still cover the part. Chances are it's probably doubled, meaning it's still being the part is covered in another instrument, but you just won't get that color. So
yeah.
Hopefully I'm never in that position where I'm out searching for an oboe. You know, they're out there and they do love to play.
Do you have anybody playing the English horn?
Well, usually the oboist will double on the English horn. So the answer is yes. I have played many pieces that require English horn. And when that happens, it mysteriously comes out of the oboist case. They have usually carry an English horn and oboe at the same time. And sometimes they have to play both instruments during a piece. But usually there's enough time to make the changeover, or sometimes it's just a dedicated part in the person for that.
Okay. Of all the instruments, that's the one I like the sound of the most for some reason.
I figured. I felt the love from you about the oboe, yes.
Well, the oboe, I used to play I needed to take up an instrument in high school, and I wound up taking up the oboe. But when I heard an English horn, I said, ooh, wow, I would have rather had that one. I like that sound better.
Yeah, it's definitely a beautiful sound, without a doubt.
Yeah, how would you call it? Because it's not like when you're playing those instruments, you're hearing a little bit of vibration kind of thing.
Right.
When you're playing
it's a little bit lower in sound than an oboe, and it has a little darker sound.
Okay. So I'm curious, by the way, because I know, like, when I was in many years ago, I was like I started to go to the High School of Music and Art, and they said, well, you have a choice. They said, you have a choice. That's the famous word, choice.
A choice of
percussion or brass. And I said, well, I'll take percussion. And then they said, well, we're not teaching percussion this semester. I went, well, you know, you just gave me a choice, and that's not. And then I said, well, I guess I'll take brass. And I said, well, I'd like to play the trumpet. And they said, no, we're giving you the French horn. And I thought, where was choice coming in to this? And I didn't really, but I realized that they wanted me to play the French horn because it was a female instrument versus if you're playing the trumpet, which is more of, they were considering a male instrument kind of thing.
Oh, interesting.
But,
yeah.
Well, I mean, 2 weeks later, I left. I left music and
well,
art.
You showed them, didn't you?
and I said, the heck with it. I'm going to go into my, go to the high school in my neighborhood. And that's when I said, oh, all right, here's the oboe. I'll play an oboe. I'll learn to play the oboe.
Yeah,
you
oboe and flute, one of the hard, and French horn are actually some of the hardest instruments to learn. You definitely picked a challenging instrument.
Yeah, the ducks would fly in when I played, but that's okay.
A little Peter and the Wolf, perhaps?
yeah. But anyway, so what is your background in music?
Well, without going too far back, I started playing the violin when I was 6, and then it just kind of progressed after that. I went to conservatory for college, and then I went to the Sibelius Academy to do postgraduate work in Finland, and I'm a violinist by profession, and I've been playing professionally, I guess, since I was about 16 years old, and now I'm older than that. And so that's basically it in a nutshell. I've had a wonderful career, I'll put it that way, of playing and playing with professionals and playing in different orchestras and for different operas and all sorts of things.
Do you ever get to be concertmaster?
Oh, many groups, yes. I got to tune many orchestras over the years. Not so much when I got older. When I got older, I let the younger ones do it. I was getting, I preferred playing second violin, actually, and I really liked the inner voicing of the instrument and the parts, and I let the young ones work harder than I had to work. So.
Oh, okay. I guess it, just for people to understand that, is I guess it's like choosing to sing harmony rather than melody.
Exactly. I had done a lot of. I played first violin in Europe. I played in professional orchestra, and I had lots of melody lines for many, many years. And when I moved to New York, for the first few years, I was always on first violin. And then one day I said, you know what, I really would like to focus on, I was working. I didn't have as much time to practice. And so I said, let me continue playing, but I'll play the second violin part and really, really embrace that. So that's what I did.
And by the way, I thought I read, did you go to Queens College?
I did. I have a master's in education from there and a supervisor's license. So, yeah, I went for quite a few years there.
So, and while you were there, I know even though you were dealing with education, did you have an opportunity to take music classes as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Most of them, I did take a sabbatical for a semester and from teaching, and I took conducting and composition and performance, and I was just into the music program. And even when I got my master's, it was in music education, so I was taking a lot of music classes then also.
Yeah, they're pretty good with for music.
They are. They have a very strong department, without a doubt.
Were you there before or after they built the, I guess it's called Lefferts?
I was there before.
Oh, okay.
And then when I took my sabbatical, I got to enjoy the new building. But everything was in the other building. Prior to that.
Yeah, nice, the acoustics. Really
right.
Nice there, huh?
Right. Well, the whole joke about the other building was the fact that the airplanes would fly overhead. So you learned to read the lips of your lecturer, you know, of your teacher, because you couldn't hear anything. So you, the lecture continued, but it would be just, you know, nothing. That was the running joke that we did a lot of. We got a degree in lip reading.
Very good. Yeah, I would take classes just like I would take a class and like I need I need a one credit and an A plus to help my grades.
So you took a music class.
So
right?
I would pick up and I go, let's see. And the funniest, of course, was taking the piano. The funniest one for me to take, having played the piano for like half most of my life.
Right.
So, you know, piano 101, and, you know, okay, well, good, got the A-plus that I needed, and then what else? And that was the funniest one, as I took up the trumpet, finally.
And finally, you finally got to play. Excellent.
Well,
see, it's never too late.
What was amusing about it is there was the class, they were all music majors except for myself, and for whatever reason, the teacher had me playing first trumpet. The only one playing first trumpet. Well,
wow.
Which I thought, well, that's nice, except there were points where my lips were getting tired.
Sure, all
the
high notes.
couldn't blow, you know, then. So if I stop blowing it, there's no melody. So he would have to run over to the piano to play the melody. You know?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. But I got my, I got the credit and the A. That's
you got your A plus. There you go.
Yeah, that's all I really wanted. But then again, that's part of the thing that you do when you're in school is it start to figure out, what can you get an A in to bring up your grades? What'll be, the easiest thing to help bring up the grades, you know? But
as opposed
to just the things you love or, you know, the things you have to take, you know, for your major kind of thing. But anyway, so I understand that did the orchestra put something on while you were away or anything?
Yes, they gave an outdoor concert at Traverse Park in Jackson Heights. It's part of the Beautification Group's concert series, summer concert series on Sundays. And for the past 3 years, we've been doing this concert. And the last 2 years, my assistant conductor, Stephen Rosenhaus, has been kind enough to lead the group and give me a little break. So we keep going. I think it's important for the orchestra to see different people in front of it, not just me. And it's good for the audience also to associate the orchestra as its own entity and not necessarily that the orchestra is me. If you know what I mean, sometimes they associate the conductor as the identity of the orchestra. And I imagine I won't be around forever, but I really want the orchestra to stand alone and take hold in the community, which I think it's doing. And I think that planting those roots early is a key to that kind of success, you know, down the line. I mean, if you look at every orchestra that's had... Yes?
Yeah.
If you look at a lot of different orchestras where the founding conductors have left, there's always a struggle. You know, there's no a very difficult transition in between before they find their way again. So not that I'm leaving. I don't want anybody to think that I'm leaving, but you have to plan for like 10 years down the line or something.
Oh, sure.
Or further. Who knows?
So, then I want to also ask, just for people who want to know, what does a conductor do? I mean, we all see somebody standing there with a wand or something kind of thing. What is the job actually entail?
Wow, that's a, you know, I get a lot of people who ask me, what does this mean when I move my hand that way? And what, you know, it's so basically the conductor starts the group off. It's not such an easy thing to get 50 people or 30 people to start all at the same time. So the conductor has to know how to do that. They have to know the score of the music. They have to know the score so that during rehearsal they can hear notes that need to be corrected or stylistic. They make artistic decisions. They help. I like to view the conductor as a facilitator, and where the facilitator helps the members of the orchestra come together towards a common goal, and it is done with musical taste and to the best of their capabilities. So basically you're a teacher, you're sometimes a dictator, though I try not to be. It doesn't really work as well as when you create an environment that's filled with collaboration and you get different ideas from different players. And I think I have fostered this. Not every orchestra does that. You know, usually the conductor is totally dictates exactly how they want it done. And you know, I'm quite open to see if there's a solo passage and the person playing it wants to do it a particular way. And if I feel that works within the context of what we're doing, why not? You know, because it allows them to express themselves. And it also gives them ownership. So I think that the role of the conductor is sort of changing. It's also the role of the conductor is also a money raiser. And, you know, there's a community outreach. And there are many things that the conductor does outside of just the rehearsals.
You're taking a piece and you're interpreting it.
That's basically
on how
it.
You want the...
In a nutshell, yes.
In a nutshell.
And there are different ways of handling that.
Okay.
Because you have so many different
personalities.
Before I get
to this fundraising thing, I'm curious, as usually on the sheet, it'll have things like, you know, words like, you know, that tell you how fast or slow or... you know, things that notate, you know, that you play louder or softer or stuff like
right.
that.
Right.
So in terms of that, you're still, a conductor is not just leaving it up to that.
Well, that's a guideline. And then there's the balancing of maybe those trumpet players are playing too loud compared to the rest of the orchestra, or even though, you know, just the way it all blends together in the, And just not the melodic line, but the harmonic line and how it stacks up on top of each other. So you're looking at it in two different levels. And then there's the dynamics that you spoke, you know, the louds and the softs and the crescendos and how soft can we be? You know, how exciting can we make this crescendo? So.
And of course, and the tempo.
And the tempo,
well.
How fast, sure, how slow, does it move along, is it dragging, is everybody going to sleep, including me? I mean, like, so, you know, you want to keep that moving along, and you want to make sure that you're breathing, and the group plays as one instrument, you know, you want them to really listen to each other and be empathetic to what's going on.
So you, when you were commenting, what kind of fundraising then are you like trying to do?
Well, I'm just talking in general as far as the role of usually the artistic director or the conductor. I mean, that's usually a major part of their obligation. But with the Jackson Heights Orchestra, our concerts are free. So we rely on donations at the door. It's a suggested usually a $10 donation with $5 for seniors and students. We don't ID anybody. You know, I mean, if you don't want to pay anything, that's fine. You know, I mean, I don't want anybody to feel like they're obligated or that they can't afford to come and hear the orchestra, because sometimes maybe somebody else will pay more, you know, than the suggested.
Right.
You know, it all balances out, and the whole thing is to offer this experience to the people in the community and other people who want to come.
And in December, do you know what pieces that you're looking at, or we're looking at to anybody in the local area?
We have a pretty good idea of what's going on. I have a new work that's being commissioned for the orchestra to celebrate the 5th year by Perry Mayer, and that's going to reflect the sounds and energy of Jackson Heights. I haven't looked at it yet. I should be getting the score to that next month in September. Thomas Piercy is going to be playing clarinet. We have yet to determine what clarinet concerto, but we have an idea. So we're doing Mozart's Symphony No. 40, and probably some overture and probably a couple of holiday tunes. And that will be that'll be it. I like to keep the concerts about to an hour and 15 minutes with no intermission. And then because they're usually on Wednesday nights. And in that way, then we have a reception afterwards, and then people get to go home. They have listened to some nice music. They get to see their friends. They get a glass of wine or not, or whatever they, you know, and some food, and off they go. It's a really fun evening.
Right.
People really enjoy coming to the concerts. They're very intimate in a sense that you get to meet the orchestra members and the soloist afterwards, and everybody's invited to the reception. It's not a question, well, you donated X amount of dollars so you can come, or, you know, you don't get to come. But, no, everybody is welcomed. And it's great. It's really, it's a very nice event in the community.
Well, December's going to come quicker than we think. Just
always.
Like, it's like, whoa, middle of August, man, already?
Right, I know, it's amazing. It just, it's the December concert shaping up. I have the March concert is sort of shaping up, and the May concert. So I have pretty much the whole season is pretty much put together, which is great.
Oh, okay. Well, it was great having you on the show. If I have any other questions for the article, I don't know if I have your email. I have your Facebook, but I don't have the email.
Well,
but
I can send it to you.
Send
there.
It on the Facebook.
Okay, you got it.
On your, you know, yes, on the chat.
On the chat, yes. Okay, absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
So if you have any questions, sure.
Sure. Okay. All right. Thanks a whole lot, Pat. And enjoy the day.
And I hope you make it to one of our concerts. That would be nice.
Oh, I'll definitely go. I like that kind of music. All right.
Excellent.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Okay, great. Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay. Well, yeah, I know, Dan, I know you're waiting, and I have to just do run, you know, sponsor, you know, yeah, I got a sponsor, so I have to run, let me run a commercial, I'm going to run this one, it's because I'm really in the mood for some milk, so here we go.
Hey, Martha, why do you smile? I was just thinking. I'm here at Ronnie Brook Farms eating delicious grass, not being injected with some synthetic hormones. I just gave birth to another cutie calf and don't even have to deal with any bull. I hear you, Mar. You know what they call cows that can't give milk? No, what, Sal? utter failure. So, where is our Big Daddy Ronnie? Probably somewhere exercising, doing yogurt. At Ronniebrook Farms, you'll find the best of dairy products. Our milks vary in butterfat, from non-fat to heavy cream. Enjoy the creamy yogurts from the cup or one that you can simply drink with the best of culture without artificial thickeners or additives. We don't have sour cream. We do have creme fraiche. Butter is better when you can choose cinnamon toast to spread on bread or pancakes. And since we scream for ice cream any time of year, you'll love our 16% butterfat. Do you remember getting bottled milk delivered, opening it to find the cream on the top? That is how you'll find our sweet-tasting, cream-lined milk. I'll hand it to you, Sal. Our milk may get past your eyes, but certainly not homogenized. Ronniebrook Farms, where cows always seem to be in a good mood. Check us out at www.ronniebrook.com.
So does that make you in the mood for a glass of milk?
That Damn. Does indeed. Nice cold one, yes.
Let's see, you can't, it's hard to get because it's not, yes, thank goodness that they have the green markets around. That's where I wind up going.
Absolutely. I feel moved to go out and get a bottle now.
Yeah, I didn't want to play the brownie commercial. That's I really want to.
I can only imagine.
I had found, like, the best brownies in the whole world kind of thing and went, oh, I got to write their commercial, too. Anyway, so, Dan, how are you?
I am good, and how are you today, Meryl?
Oh, I'm doing good. It's cool enough that the fan is doing okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Way across the rooms from the air conditioner, so I'll be able to talk for a while. So let's get to, by the way, and it's just, I guess it's my eyes, I guess. I've had been having trouble reading the print in the book because I tried, like, I have, you know, reading glasses, and I put them on,
gotcha.
And it's still not quite big enough, so I don't know if it's the light. I got to try it in a different room, and it could be because of, you know, the page may have some glare that's interfering, but I have to, you know. But I still got enough of a gist, at least, of what this is all about.
Good.
Because I got that. You know, most of the things, it was like there's like two photos on each page, and one seems to be past and one seems to be present. This is in a lot of it, not all of it, but I had noticed that pattern. So, I'll let you talk about the book. What's the name of the book? Tell everybody.
Sure. The name of the book is Broad Channel Through Time. It is authored by myself, Dan Guarino, and also I got to be the principal photographer for the new photos in it. The publisher is Font Hill Media and done in conjunction with Arcadia Publishing and History Books. And it just came out on Monday, August 15th.
Oh.
So it's brand spanking new.
Oh, that's why you're having the book signing on Saturday, huh?
Yes, I am having a book signing on this coming Saturday, August the 20th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at what is called Grassy's, or more formally the Grassy Point Bar and Grill in Broad Channel, just off Cross Bay Boulevard.
Mm. All right, so now, of course, tell us what made you decide to do this book.
Okay, that is an interesting story. It's a bit longer story. A few years ago, Arcadia Publishing had approached my late wife, Liz Guarino, about doing a book for their series, which is called Images of America. And many people may have seen the books in that series. I know they're all across the country. And they generally cover, go into specific areas. Sometime last year I was at the Grand Canyon, and they had Images of America books about the Grand Canyon, about Las Vegas, about the Hoover Dam. And they're sort of sepia tone covered books that many people will be familiar with once they've seen them. There's also a series along this line in England and in Germany. So they had contacted and asked if she'd be interested in doing a book called Images of America Broad Channel. And she, in turn, at the time asked me, he's like, would you be interested in doing it? I said, yeah, that would be fun. That would be an adventure, be something new. And so we set about doing what turned out to be the first published book about the history of Broad Channel, with almost 200 vintage historical pictures of Broad Channel in it. And it was really an interesting endeavor in terms of research, in terms of writing it, of gathering the photos, of scanning the photos, which I did for the very first time. I'd never worked with a scanning program before. And it was very interesting. And also we felt a great responsibility in representing Broad Channel, or as we say, this town, representing it well, doing right by doing this history, especially for the first one. So that was the first book, and that was great. In the meantime, you know, time passed along. My wife passed away, went through Hurricane Sandy. And not too long ago, a new publisher, Font Hill Media, approached me and said, listen, we have a series in our line of books called Through Time. Would you be interested in doing a Through Time book about Broad Channel? So I looked at that and said, oh, okay, you know, what is this series about? And what they do in this series is they take a place, could be anywhere. The sample book they sent me was Washington, D.C. Through Time. And it pairs up vintage historical photos of a particular place alongside photos from, generally speaking, from something from today. And then in the text you get to talk about what's changed, what's the same, go into a little bit of the history. And I looked at this and said, huh, okay. And they were interested in doing Broad Channel Through Time. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do a Broad Channel book, I'd like to do something different, something interesting. And I got to do, most of the photography for today. So even though I'm also an exhibiting photographer, I didn't do any of the photography in the previous book. But this one, I got to go in, not only research and come up with a whole new set, a new slew of historical photos to add, but also I got to go around to these different places and take photos of what they look like today or something similar, as well as do the research and come up with the stories and so forth. And that in itself was an interesting adventure. So that's the short version of how this book came about.
Are they all outsides of the buildings, or did you have to go inside of any of the homes or buildings or, you know, things like that?
Sure. Well, most of them are from the outside or exteriors, because that's the most familiar thing. But there were some interesting exceptions there, in that some of them are inside the places. Some are actually groups of people. And finding a 21st century counterpart to those. For instance, there's a historic photo from the 1940s, and a group of volunteers of women through the church who got together and wrote letters to servicemen overseas as a contribution, kind of personalized letters to the men in service. And then in the present day, I looked for something like that, you know, a group of people also doing something in service to other people. And I found, for instance, photos I'd taken at a round-the-clock cancer walk, and then other things like, you know, political clubs that had formed, and then people doing things like, you know, volunteering and sprucing up the community. So there were a lot of things like that, and also, you know, groups of people, places, and things like that that were more inside and covered, you know, not, say, just necessarily buildings and structures, which you could identify, but really also the story of people here. One of my favorites in the book is I have a photo of the congregation of Christ Presbyterian Church by the sea. And as it turns out, I have some old, very old photos of the outside of the church when there's really nothing but dirt roads around it. But also this particular photo I had taken a few years ago was of the congregation in the totally sandy destroyed church hall. And I was there. It was a very, very, very cold, cold day. The inside had been stripped down to the boards. You could really see even the original outside of the church, which was the church hall had been added onto. And what they were there talking about in 2013, 2012, was having to figure out how to rebuild the church after the hurricane. So, and everyone's in winter coats, everyone's huddling together because there's no heat whatsoever, there's practically no building, but there they are. And I have this great group photo of showing them very determined and even smiling, looking and saying, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to figure out how to do this. We're going to band together, we're going to do this. And I juxtapose that somewhat historical picture with a picture of the of an event going on in the church hall after it's been beautifully rebuilt, and you know, it looks very warm and people are in short sleeve shirts. So it's kind of taking that not just the buildings, not just the larger history, but the story of the people, and trying to show that as well, trying to show the community a broad channel, which is really more than just the buildings and places. And larger events, the book is really about that as well. About, you can't, for me, you can't untie the twin stories, the twin strands of Broad Channel as a place from Broad Channel as a story about its people and its community.
Now, do you find, in terms of the people living there, that that people, like, they get a house and they're forever going to live there, as opposed to, you know, like, okay, I'm going to sell my house and go someplace else? You find that they've been doing, like, passing it on, whatever they can, versus, you know, just a constant change?
That's a very good question. In fact, the idea of home and ownership really shapes a lot of Broad Channel history. When Broad Channel really first began to develop, it actually became the first biggest thing that happened. It became a stop along the railroad that was built in the 1880s, really to bring people from Brooklyn, from Manhattan, to Rockaway, which at the time was the kind of the playground where everybody wanted to be, including, you know, the very rich. So when Broad Channel became a stop along that new railroad, which eventually became the Long Island Railroad and eventually became part of the subway system, it was able to develop as a place where people could get off, could bring in goods, could actually live there. But it was really first developed as a kind of a bungalow rental community, as a summer vacation spot that the working man could afford in his salary. So the land actually was originally leased from the city, and as time went on and as people began to live here full-time, they could own the houses, in some cases many of which had been built by the people here, but they couldn't own the land. And what you had then were a lot of people who stayed here, generations of people who stayed here, who lived here because they loved the place, and they were ingrained in it and part of it, intertwined in its history. And also, it was easier really to pass on the houses to succeeding generations because you could sell a house but not the land under it. So that was one factor in Broad Channel's history and why part of the reason why the community is so together as it is, because it is generational. But the other thing is that even once they could, after a 40-year, yes, a four-decade-long fight to be able to buy the land, is a lot of people stayed because this is home. There is, as some people say, there is no place like the channel. There is no place like Broad Channel. And that I find is very true. And even the people that move in who haven't lived here all their lives, like myself, I've been here about, I would say, around 25 to 30 years. There's something about this place that once you're here, you really don't just want to just move someplace else. It is really not like any place else that you could live. So it's not like, I'll live here for a while, then I'll sell my house and move elsewhere. It's like, there's really no place like this. Even people that were displaced by the hurricane had this really strong pull to be back, to be part of this town, to be part of this community.
And in terms of the hurricane, like if you want to go like a percentage, how much has been fixed up and how much is like, you know, still in the destruct mode because the insurance hasn't paid or whatever, FEMA and all, whatever, that should have, you know, taken care of it.
Sure. I will say that even at the time I looked at the hurricane as a whole new chapter in the history of Broad Channel and maybe even a whole new volume in Broad Channel's history. And at the time of the hurricane, and certainly we are joined in this by our neighbors in Rockaway, and up and down Rockaway, and Howard Beach, and Hamilton Beach, and all across the eastern seaboard of the United States, in that we all went through this experience, and we're kind of bound together by it. In Broad Channel, the entire island, except for a very small portion, was completely covered in water. I would say on an average of at least 6 feet of water, except for a very, very, very small portion. And it was covered in water for a number of hours, until tides finally receded. So there really wasn't a structure, a building, a business, a home, a family, what have you, that wasn't touched by the hurricane, physically and emotionally. And then to see everything around you, again, like Rockaway, which is also very near and dear to my heart, that wasn't touched and devastated by it. And it's interesting, though, that the next day after the hurricane, and I was here for the hurricane, I looked out on that night, because I'd been busily working on something, and I looked out, and there were actually waves rolling through the streets. There were boats rolling through the streets on those waves. I saw one it came down a side street. It made a left turn as if it was being piloted and passed between a house and a phone pole and then sort of swung around, jammed its aft end into a phone pole, and jammed its front end into a deck on the front of one of my neighbors across the street. And the water just kept creeping up. You know, I saw it creep up as it was beginning to go into the first floors of houses of neighbors of mine across the way. And some of them are only one story. Where I was, it came up about, I would say, about 5 or 6 feet. You know, thankfully I was on the second floor. But, of course, this had a major impact. But interesting enough, the next day, as people came out, as everything was devastated, we had no heat, no electricity, no phone, no television, no cable, no cell phones, no cars because they'd all been completely submerged. So we had no contact with any place else in the world, really. Nobody could go anywhere. And we're an island. You really couldn't just walk over and say, well, how are things going in the next neighborhood? But as early as the next morning, people were pulling out debris, people were making room, people were doing what they could, people were helping neighbors wherever they could, people were gathering their resources or food or whatever they had to help each other. And I can say that I heard people even then saying, okay, well, let's get to work and start rebuilding. And it was that kind of that attitude, that mentality is like, hey, we have suffered a great blow, but you know what? We're in this together. We're a town, and we're going to see what we can do together. Now, you know, complicating that issue for many people, and I've seen this far and wide, beyond Broad Channel, beyond Rockaway, is exactly that, is FEMA, insurance, regulations. And some people even said then, it's like, you know what? I'd like to rebuild. I'd like to start rebuilding now. But if I raise my house, I'm not sure. Is that going to be a problem with the insurance? Is that going to be a problem with other help? If I build it up, is it going to be too low because the new standards haven't been issued yet? Is it going to be too high? And a lot of people were in kind of limbo for a while because it wasn't just the hurricane. You know, as I tell people, it's kind of like, I mean, besides all the emotional things you've got to deal with, you know, that devastation, and the very basics of, okay, now we've got to find food, heat, laundry, and so forth. It's like if your car was wrecked, and then you think, okay, well, I've got to go out and get my car fixed. Then somebody's going to come along and say, well, but with the insurance, with federal regulations, with other things like that, your car has to be totally rebuilt. Oh, and its tires need to be 14 feet off the ground, and you've got to kind of wait for us to get around to it. So right now, things are a lot further than they were almost 4 years ago in Broad Channel. And things are picking up a pace. I've noticed that a lot of houses are now being either raised, renovated, or rebuilt. But there's still a ways to go. And for people who've been through a devastation like that, a national disaster, things have seemed to move way too slow, and there's still people waiting, unfortunately. No. Things are a lot better, but they have a ways to go.
So if you're driving through, let's say, would you, you know, would people kind of say, oh, what hit this town? If they didn't know, look at it as something hit this town? Or, you know.
Yeah, that is a very interesting question and observation for both in Broad Channel and also in Rockaway. Those of us who live here and who've been living here through the storm and the aftermath, we kind of look and we forget how much has become normalized over time. And every once in a while you might be recalled, you know, if you see a water line or something that looks, you know, that it has really hasn't been worked on in a number of years, then it comes back to you. But things have become so normal.
One of the things that I'm curious about, because, like, okay, so now coming from Woodhaven, now once I go over the, I don't know what to call that, what would you call the bridge? The Cross Bay Bridge?
Well, the first bridge you probably come across is the, which is also in the book, by the way, and its predecessor, is the Joseph P. Addabbo Bridge, which connects Broad Channel to the rest of, as they say, mainland Queens. In this case, the next neighborhood is
What was it called before Joseph Addabbo?
In its previous life, or as a previous bridge, it was the North Channel Bridge. And bridge was originally built in the 1920s. So if you think about it in terms of Broad Channel history, before that, there was no way to get to the island by bridge. You had to come by boat or by train. And before the train, you can only come by boat.
So what happens is then when I get over there, then I go through this long, like, strip of land that basically on one side or the other side it just has, is part of Jamaica Bay.
Right.
And it's then, and then I get what starts, I guess, the beginning of town. Okay. So from the point of, let's just to get a sense of what people get a sense of, from the point of when I hit town to the next bridge, the bridge that, you know, goes over to the Rockaways, how long is that strip, would you know, approximately?
Sure. It's a good question. It's, for some reason, it has varying answers. The general estimation of the size of Broad Channel as an island is approximately 2.5 to 3 miles. The town is probably about a mile or two, and the width of it is probably at its widest maybe a quarter mile. That is, you can't really go too far to the east or west without encountering Jamaica Bay. But it's interesting because many people don't even realize it's an island because they do come over one bridge, and then they're on they're on Cross Bay Boulevard, or as people further north in Queens may know it as at that point is Woodhaven Boulevard, which turns into Cross Bay. And then you come through a large area on your left and right, which is actually the Jamaica Bay Wildlife Refuge, which is part of the National Park Service, and also part of a pretty huge chunk of the national parks, which is called the Gateway National Recreation Area. And it's actually, interestingly enough, it's kind of a holdover or probably the result of something that Robert Moses wanted to do originally, and it is known throughout the world as a spot to be for bird watching and nature. And then you have the town itself. You have Broad Channel itself, which is houses and businesses on either side. And then you go over the next bridge, which is the Cross Bay Bridge, and into Rockaway.
Okay. I guess what the thing that I was curious about is to see whether it is the town is the word walkable. In other words, if you went from one end of the town to the other, how much of a walk it would be.
Oh, sure. It is absolutely walkable. It is, as they say, a healthy walk, but you could certainly do it.
Right.
In fact, there's a book by an author I got to meet called Walking Queens, and there is a section about Broad Channel, and it takes you step by step through it. But sure, you could definitely walk Broad Channel. Many people do as exercise. Recently, we had a charity walk run that covered a lot of it. And sometimes, you know, people, and rather than get in their car, if there's an event or such, they'll say, "Well, we'll just walk up. You know, we'll put the kids in strollers. We'll, you know, cart along a cooler, and we'll just walk there."
Do you have like ample amount of like shopping for, you know, in terms of buying food, or do you have to go to the mainland or either the mainland or in the Rockaways?
Oh, sure. Well, we're very much connected to Rockaway, which Broad Channel is indeed considered a part of, for the most part. What we have here in Broad Channel currently,
the problem is that when you're going over a bridge, now you're paying a toll, unfortunately.
You're paying
a toll to go into the Rockaway. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, if you could stick to your own town where you don't have to pay a toll, you know, it's probably, you know, in terms of, like, food shopping, that's why I was asking. Is there any major, like, a major supermarket?
We don't have one here. Interesting enough, and I kind of found this, and my late wife and I found this as we went further in Broad Channel's history, is that over time it had hotels, it had restaurants, it had dance halls, it had all kinds of stores. It had an A&P at one point, and other things like an outdoor movie, a miniature golf course, an airstrip. There was actually even a military base here. But currently what we have is we have a nice selection of groceries and delis, pizza places, and so forth. If you needed something like a supermarket, then you could go north into mainland Queens, into Howard Beach, or into Rockaway for supermarkets and things like that. There is the toll. Currently, Broad Channel and Rockaway residents have a kind of an instant rebate, which essentially makes the toll free, but there's still a toll.
Oh.
And one of the issues has always been for Rockaway and for Broad Channel is that people coming to visit or shop or play have to pay this toll to do that. And at any point they could say, well, we no longer have the instant rebate program, so now you've all got to pay a toll to go back and forth. And interestingly, it's the only toll in the United States that you pay to go within the same, essentially within the same community. So you're not from Brooklyn to Manhattan or anything like that. You're paying it to go within the same area, within the same community with the same zip code.
Same county.
Yes. So yes. It's been an ongoing fight to really eliminate the toll at some point. Because not only, again, by whim, if, say, the governor, new governor comes in and wants to change that, they can, but also every visitor coming through Broad Channel or going to Rockaway has to pay this toll, has to pay a toll to get in. It's almost like it's going to cost you more to go from here to there.
Right.
And that has an effect on the economy of the whole area, especially now that...
Oh, sure.
Place like Rockaway has become very popular, and people are paying more attention to Broad Channel. It's it's a factor. It's a factor, and that's been another ongoing thing. Has been the toll fight to just eliminate it, to no longer have it as a factor for either residents or visitors. Now it's. Yeah, it's an ongoing, and it's interesting because it is one of those ongoing stories throughout Broad Channel history that you find, including, by the way, I might add, and this is mentioned in the book, seemingly no longer, although it was a thought after Hurricane Sandy, is that the powers that be might decide to finally move Broad Channel as a community off the island, and there have been at least four major pushes over the past, and we're talking about in less than the last 100 years, to push the community off the island altogether. And Broad Channel is known as the last inhabited island in Jamaica Bay, and part of that reason, there were other communities here in Jamaica Bay on other islands that were eventually pushed off by the city. And there were plans. Robert Moses wanted to turn it into a half wildlife refuge, half sort of water amusement area. Kennedy Airport wanted to expand its runways and therefore move Broad Channel off. There were a number of times like that when the city or whomever wanted to just push the community off the island altogether, like the other communities. And one of the interesting things is that Broad Channel sort of dug in, banded together as a community, and pooled their resources and say, no, we're not going. We're not moving. So Broad Channel, one of its number of nicknames is the little town that fought City Hall and won. And it's still here today. And it really gives you a good feeling part of a community like that. That's, that has that cohesiveness like that. Not everybody thinks the same way or acts in lockstep, but everybody realizes, like, you know what, this is our town, this is our community, and we're all in this together. We really, really all are in this together. If anything, I think, and for a lot of areas, but definitely Broad Channel, definitely certainly Rockaway, is that the experience of Hurricane Sandy and its aftermath really, really brought that home. You know, your neighbors really were the people that you turned to, and no matter how bad off they were there ready to give you a hand with whatever they had or didn't have.
So, okay, now let me ask you another question. I mean, with all the restaurants like in Howard Beach, right, like is there any restaurants to say, well, yes, there are in Howard Beach, but we have such and such. We have a couple of restaurants here that are, you know, worth schlepping over for.
Okay.
Are there any, you know, other than maybe a pizzeria?
Oh, sure. Well, and of course, to give all due respect to our two pizzerias here.
Well,
absolutely. And of course, we have a great bagel place, the All-American Bagel and Barista Company, too. I almost left out. We have two great bars, Ruffle Bar and Grassy's. And Grassy's does, when the kitchen is open, have great food. So now that I've covered them, there is a restaurant here. It's been around for quite a while. Really got hit by the storm. In fact, I was there the next day, and I looked through the front door, and straight through to the back, I could see the waters of Jamaica Bay. That's how badly it was blown out. It's called the Bayview, one word, mm-hmm. Bayview. And within the past number of months, just this year, they reopened, totally renovated. Beautiful, beautiful looking place, and as the Bayview Grill and Marina, and it's really quite a restaurant. I would say it's different than what you can really get anyplace else. Just through the decor, the food is great, the bar is great, and then they have this tremendous, beautiful deck, so you can go out and you can enjoy a drink or you can enjoy dinner right on Jamaica Bay. And then beyond that, they have live music, they have bands, they have different events going on. So it's certainly worth checking out, worth going by, and the atmosphere is really like no place else, because you're one to
people
that sort of, you know, know each other from one town or very welcoming. So.
Yeah, because then, you know, there are people that go, all right, been there, done that, and then he got it. What else? Where else could we go? You know?
Yeah, and it's a great, as are many places, and I guess this goes back to the book, is great for the story within the story, i.e. that this is a place that really got battered, that really got tossed around and kind of stayed as is for a while, but the owners came back and part of their, you know, not only as a business, but as part of the, what they saw as being part of the community is that they put it back together, and it reemerged. It reemerged bigger and better after Hurricane Sandy. Like, you know, you're not going to really, you're not going to knock us down. So,
well, I'm just curious. Like, do the owners live in Broad Channel as well?
Yes. Let me see. There are three owners, and I know definitely at least one of them lives in Broad Channel, and there are owners that have and. That owner, as well as others, have parts in different businesses throughout the channel. So
because I'm curious as to, in terms of businesses that are in Broad Channel, do you find that a lot of it is, most of it, or a lot of it are people that actually live there?
Oh, sure. And some of them going back quite a ways, like the owners of Grassy's. I've been around in one incarnation or another for, gosh, it's got to be over half a century. And the owners, in fact, the current owner, it was passed on to him from his dad, who's certainly very much a part of Broad Channel as well. So, yeah, there are a lot of places here that are owned by people that live in the channel, and each place considers itself to be part of the community rather than it's just a business in any place USA.
Okay. Well, from what I could tell with the book, as I said, like it was just difficult for my eyes to read, but from the sense that I get of what I could read, this is a coffee table book. Is that what the...
it's interesting because you can appreciate this book on a number of different levels. One is that, sure, the pictures are great, and I get a bang out of the historical pictures. I've always been interested in history in the large sense and in the smaller stories within it. I get that from my both my parents. And the older pictures are great. I think the oldest one is from 1908 and shows a coal-driven train steaming across Jamaica Bay. The new pictures, I have done my very best to make them not only representative but also visually interesting. As a visual artist, that was something that was key to me. It's like, I know you can take a picture of something and, well, that's a nice picture of a building or a field or whatever it might be or a group of people, but I also like it to make it visually interesting for people who are going to pick it up and look at it. So you
right.
can certainly enjoy the pictures, old and new. The text itself gives you another layer. So if you want to delve into that, it will give you something of the history of Broad Channel, which, again, is very surprising for a seemingly quiet community. I mean, at one time during Prohibition, one of the nicknames for Broad Channel was Little Cuba. In that being an island, it was a great place to have speakeasies, to have distilleries, to have a homemade alcohol being produced. And you could reach it by boat very easily. You could, you know, land or go under certain buildings and deliver at that time what was illegal liquor and then be off again. If police were coming, you could see them for a long way off, so one business would let another know, one community person would let another know, and so on and so on. So it was kind of a very interesting place where a lot of people, even the celebrities, came to not only entertain in the nightclubs, but also enjoy themselves as well. So there are stories like that in it that you can enjoy. And if you're a history person, it's something you can enjoy as well. For me, one of the things I like doing about and is very ingrained in me is to make things enjoyable and accessible to really anybody. I mean, I know from people that I know, you get very, very deeply into history and the facts and figures, and I know people that, whether you want them to or not, can go on for hours and hours about every detail, about everything. But for me, I've always enjoyed just being able to relate this to pretty much anybody, to give them that sense of these things without having to be a heavy lift or load. And that's something I try to do with this book as well, is if you're from Broad Channel or if you know the area, which seemingly very, very many people do, you can enjoy this book. You might get an extra kick out of seeing certain things or even people you know in the pictures. And if you're not necessarily from Broad Channel, you have a casual interest, you can pick this up and read it and enjoy it and enjoy the text and the pictures and some of the, again, very surprising things about it without having to have a professorship in history. So I've tried my best to make that accessible so really anybody can enjoy it. And, of course, the fact that the color doesn't hurt either. It's really, I mean, the first time I saw the cover of the book or the proofs for it, which was designed by the publisher, and it was in color, and I saw the black and white older photo at the top and the color picture, which, you know, even though it was one of my own, I was like, wow, that really looks nice. I like that. So
it is eye-catching in terms of reading that, like, you could kind of said, well, the history is the black and white, like the kind of most of it, like, you know, the top is kind of the black and white history, and except for when you get much later in the book, there are some color photos of history.
Yes, you run into that, and then throughout the book, since it is historical and today, you get a nice mix of both, and then you get to see, like, wow, there's a lot of similarities between old and new. There's a lot of continuity. And the other cool thing about this book, which, again, goes to my feeling about history as well as a lot of other subjects, is that it's living. That is, this book allowed me to bring the history through to the present, to connect those two things, to make this not only a book with pictures of things that happened, 50 or 100 years ago, but also show that how that's connected to today and to capture this moment in Broad Channel's present and a little bit about his future. Because much of this book is a portion, for instance, about Hurricane Sandy. So I connected this to earlier storms, like in the 1930s and so forth, and then pictures of the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, and then pictures of afterwards, of what it looks like today, where it's cleaned up or rebuilt or on its way to doing that. And
sure.
I say, what it allowed me to do was not only to tell the story of a place, granted a very unique and special place, but also to tell the story of a community, of people in this community, in this town, who are also very unique and special and remarkable in their own ways, community. So all of that, this book allowed me to do, which I'm very, very honored to do that. I really wanted to do right by this community in doing this book and doing it right, as with the previous book, with this one.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, I'm. It was great having you chat. And
you as well.
Of course, I got your email, and if I have any other questions to write the article, I'll email that as well. I'm going to say I'm not sure if I can if I can make it there on Saturday. I would also like to visit the restaurant Bayview.
Sure.
Like give them a call and see what I could arrange, because I want to try to promote some places that are in Broad Channel, which I've never done.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And just in terms of even coming here and walking around or walking by the edges of the bay, it's really it's an amazing place to even just see visually Jamaica Bay, the classic, as they say, houses out on stilts, the canals here that are in back of some of the houses on the west side. It's really quite a stunning place. And I have had people more than a few times say to me, are you sure we're still in New York City? No, we're not. We're still in New York City. I said, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
<Yeah. laughs>
In fact, we're on an island, but we're still in New York City, and you can see it from here. You get a beautiful view of the Manhattan skyline, as well as the sunrise, the sunset, the geese, the trains, the planes. It's as they say, there is no place like the Channel.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Dan. And, we'll be in touch. And have an absolutely wonderful day.
Oh, you too. And if you're by Saturday, hopefully I will see you at the Grassy Point Bar and Grill on Cross Bay Boulevard and Broad Channel from 1 to 4 for the book signing. So,
and
okay. People can pick up a copy there, or they can go to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. It will be available at all those outlets.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on the
Absolutely
show.
Fabulous.
Terrific.
As
so
said.
Have a
great day. Right.
Everybody else there, enjoy.
Okay, thanks. Okay, bye, Dan.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. So, I'm going to end the show. And now I have more information for the article that I'm writing. So the chickens are sleeping, the cats are sleeping because they got fed. You know how cats are. They eat, they go to the bathroom, they sleep. And then they eat, and they go to the bathroom, and they sleep. But because I have two of them, then they play with each other. They have playtime with each other. They have bother the mother time, that kind of thing. But anyway, so everybody have a great day, afternoon, evening, or whatever, whenever you're listening. I'm having chicken.